Oh, I got it helps if I turn it on. Okay. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for coming. You know, normally if we were to hold a conference on climate change and security and the environment, we'd have about, maybe 60 people show up, you know, but it does help to have a transition. You know, a lot of people want to know what the hell is going on and is this a time when things will happen and what directions are they going to take? It's just a kind of an exciting time. It's a very interesting time. And I don't think there's an issue of that is probably going to be more at the top of the landscape of issues than this one going forward. There has been this groundswell of interest in dealing with global climate change, but we've had the politics get rich. But we've not had the intellectual foundation get strong. And I think that's really where we're at now. And the purpose for this is to try to provide a starting point for some of that. It's the inevitable work that has to be done. Politics can, without a policy framework, is just endless energy, you know, but it doesn't have a sense of direction. And for it to have direction that results in something, it has to be informed by the expertise that comes with knowledgeable people willing to engage in a public discussion about the directions for the country and what they can do about it. So it's very important, and this is going to be a great session today. There are many people that have made this possible. I especially want to welcome back Conrad Lautenbacher. He told me that he has not yet written his speech, but then again, that's because he's no longer in the government, okay? And there's no longer an army out there, or navy in his case, that was prepared to give him drafts. And so he's now a private citizen again. I'd like to say thank you, Conrad, for everything you did. You just did, when you were in the Navy, you did a spectacular job. And, of course, at NOAA, I think it's just been exceptional service. And we're all a bit diminished because you have left. But we're very grateful that you did lead in such a remarkable way. And I want to thank you. That. Thank you for coming today, too. We're going to have our panelists are here. I'm told you're all going to come up here and sit down. So why don't you all move up and sit up here in the front while I'm introducing Ron Sugar. Now, Ron and I go back a long way. He's held up a hell of a lot better than I have. And I'm really very proud that Ron is now, of course, the CEO at Northrop Grumman. We were talking this morning, I asked Ron, how long have you been CEO? Well, 5.5 years. So, you know, when he first started, the average tenure of a CEO was 7.5 years. He said, but right now the average is 3.5 years. Okay, and so he's already working, 180% over expectation, which has certainly been my experience. He's energetic and driving and creative and enormously committed. You know, that good things happen in the government, and knowing that there's a very positive role that the private sector plays in making good things happen for the government. Much of my personal thinking on this conference stemmed back to a dinner we had several months ago when Ron was talking about the way that, you know, new tools need to be brought to this problem. You know, we've got, as I said, we've got a lot of passion, but we don't necessarily have the new tools. So we talked, and getting a CEO to agree to come to a think tank is hard. I mean, just say because their orbit and their interests have to revolve around the shareholders and shareholder value. But Ron, to his credit, sees a larger purpose and was willing to join us. So Ron, why don't you come up and get us started with our conversation? Thank you all for coming, and welcome, Ron Sugar.
Well, thank you, John, and wow, what a terrific turnout this is. I'm honored to be your kickoff speaker, and particularly since I'm not the kind of speaker you might normally expect to be talking about climate or the environment. But this is a good time to hold this event. We're between the recent frenzy of the election and the upcoming inauguration, and it's a good time because the issues discussed today by all of us are going to have to be addressed by the new administration and by the new Congress. In Poznan, Poland, right now, the international community has come together to continue its progress toward a new pact to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Here in the U.S., we're grateful to CSIS, to Dr. Hamry, for keeping the profile of this issue so high and relevant. And this program today, of course, is going to continue that momentum. In President-elect Obama's remarks to a climate change conference of the governors in Los Angeles, which is my hometown, he underlined what we all know, and that is the climate is changing, and those changes will have enormous impacts on our world, on our economies, and on our collective security. Hence, my company's deep interest in this topic. We all know the consequences of doing nothing to prepare for these coming changes. But this morning, I would like to offer some hopeful news associated with climate change. For the next few minutes, I'd like to talk about the core of technical capabilities and expertise that has been developed over many years by the folks in the national security industry, capabilities that could be leveraged and applied to the challenges of climate change. I would also like to touch on the opportunities and societal benefits of doing so, which could be immense. But to realize those benefits, we will have to build something that currently does not exist. We will have to build a bridge between the massive abundant scientific data available now, on the one hand, and the ability to translate that data into practical decision quality knowledge. Let me explain what I mean by this by means of an example. Ship captains of centuries past spent their lives learning to navigate in their local waters. Over years of trial and error, the best of them learned where to find the most favorable winds, where to avoid contrary currents and other data that made the difference between safety and disaster and between profit and loss on their voyage. Because they and their nations hoarded their hard-won information like treasure, few felt knowledgeable enough to venture out of their own familiar waters. For most of them, ocean navigation was more an oral tradition than a scientific method, and the data points they sought comprised the sum total of understanding they thought available to them. Everything else they believed was unpredictable, and randomness was the natural order of the seas. But there was order in that randomness. Unbeknownst to them, useful information about wind directions and storm patterns was in fact predictable in some sense many years in advance, even in waters in which they never sailed. They knew that the limited information they spent their career seeking would be useful, but it was the information they were unaware of that would have introduced them to a new world of navigational solutions, capabilities, and unimagined opportunities. I submit to you that it is possible we are in just such a similar state of understanding about climate change. We now record a tremendous amount of Earth monitoring data from satellites, from sensors on aircraft, on balloons, from sensors deep in the oceans or buried underground. These sensors are found all over the globe. They might belong to any number of nations, and their voluminous data is analyzed by many international scientific institutions. NASA, NOAA, the United States Geological Survey, EPA, the Department of Energy, universities, and others have been performing an incredible service to the progress of climate science by collecting and analyzing this data. And the sensors they operate must be maintained and expanded. The environmental data they have been producing is largely the reason we can even foresee the next evolution of climate understanding, an evolution that must occur if our efforts to create practical mitigation and adaptation options are to be anything more than merely an aspiration. With a few worthy exceptions, that evolution has not yet happened. Why not? I believe it's because we still suffer from an excess of data and a deficiency or a deficit of knowledge. Currently, too much of the data generated by these many sensors are segregated from each other, as are too many of the world's institutions that operate them. And that's not all. For understandable reasons, these data are highly scientific in nature. They are used to feed the many climate models that are so indispensable to the progress of climate science. But these models are complex in the province of scientific and academic communities. For the most part, they produce exactly what they were designed to produce, illustrations of the climate on a global scale and to a generalized timeline. In addition, these models are in their infancy relative to what is yet to come and relative to what is needed for practical purposes. All in all, the veritable ocean of sensor data makes for good science, but its benefits outside that realm are still limited. But what if all that raw environmental data could be turned into practical decision-quality knowledge for use by the greater society? What if the products from all these many sensors and information sources could be integrated and consolidated to provide the next evolution of our climate understanding, a level of understanding that could open up a new world of benefits and opportunities that we might not now even imagine? And what if that new understanding of our climate were networked beyond the scientific community to help inform public policy and business decisions at a regional or even local level? This is currently what is being done on a macro level with NOAA's Global Earth Observation Systems of Systems, GEOS. GEOS will eventually integrate the world's Earth observing systems on a global basis and make Earth information universally available for the benefit of society. And as Dr. Hamry mentioned, we are fortunate today to have Admiral Conrad Lautenbacher with us. Connie is the man who more than any other deserves the credit for GEOS. He has been a true visionary in his understanding of the power of integration and knowledge management, and he'll be speaking later to you as well. I do not advocate duplicating the work of GEOS or any other agency or office in the area of data integration, nor do I contend that the private sector could do this all better on its own than the government. I simply contend that it may be well timed to take the next step to create a higher level structural mechanism under government leadership which builds on our scientific successes to date. What I'm calling for is for the new administration to undertake a national initiative to leverage those investments to provide broad access to decision quality climate knowledge. This is a really hard problem, but the payoff will be enormous. And that's what makes this effort worthy of a national initiative. And finally, I believe that many of the tools and techniques required to do this have already been developed by the defense and information technology industries. Here's the task that calls to us: to tame an ocean of data for practical uses. And here is quite possibly the best opportunity for our nation and our next administration to demonstrate global leadership on the issue of climate change. There are any number of ways that this vision might manifest itself. One may be through the establishment of what we might be calling regional decision support centers. Think of these as information portals, broadly accessible to national, regional, local, and private sector decision makers. One could foresee such centers being staffed with their own analysts and experts and equipped with their own high-powered computing infrastructure. The professional staffs, the operational processes, even the broadband networks of these centers could be closely interfaced with other federal agencies, state, local, as well as international and public institutions. In this way, these centers could access GEOS and other data and integrate it into useful information relevant to specific problems or a decision that had to be made in a specific region. As I said earlier, I believe many of the tools and technologies have already been developed to attack this problem. They have been developed for national security applications. Let me give you a couple of examples. The astonishing pace of data gathering technology was initially a double-edged sword for our military commanders, offering them unprecedented situational awareness of the battle space on the one hand, but severe information overload on the other, not unlike what we're seeing with the massive scientific climate data. Commanders who needed to forward specific information relative to a unit as small as an infantry squad or a pair of attack jets were required to literally sip water from a fire hose, as they would put it. They had to be able to pull out that tiny thread of relevant information from a mountain of data and get it quickly. What they needed was the ability to access and integrate their data, make sense of it, and share it on a network with their forces. The solution was a combination of computing power and expertise that allowed the different categories of intelligence, whether it was imagery, communications intercepts, or others, to be combined and correlated out of a massive body of data. The breakthrough was the ability of the commander to tailor his information search by time and map coordinates, all the while other commanders in other places were able to do the same thing at the same time for their specific needs. This problem has been a tough nut to crack, and the technologies designed to do it continue to progress and improve. Today, while not perfect, no one does this better than America's military. This quest for the next evolution of climate understanding and for the practical benefits achieving it might induce objections to both its expense and its expanse. First of all, the establishment and operational costs of such regional support decision centers, if that's the way we decided to implement this, might cost several hundred million dollars a year. But remember, knowledge, like interest, compounds. Once acquired, knowledge gives an infinite and unforeseen return for the investment. And when government and private sector join in a common effort, each doing what it does best, then a true knowledge base takes root, and the benefits can be astronomical, even if they are frequently unforeseen at first. Placed against that potential, the initial establishment costs would amount to pennies on the dollar. To illustrate this point, let me close with a characteristically American tale of vision, innovation, and resulting dividends. In 1842, an obscure U.S. Navy lieutenant named Matthew Fontaine Maury was placed in charge of the collection of ships' logs dating back to the birth of our Navy. Regulations required that the log of every U.S. Navy ship be sent to Maury's depot after each voyage. Within each log were recorded daily measurements of position, wind velocity and direction, ocean temperature, the speed and the direction of ocean currents, and other data. These dusty, neglected logs would change the world understanding of its oceans, for Maury saw in them a way to turn data into shared knowledge, and in the process to evolve the understanding of our oceans to a higher level. Maury assigned himself the enormous task of integrating all their data into a new type of chart, a chart that predicted wind direction and ocean conditions for any time of the year. He also managed to globalize his data gathering through a set of international recording and reporting standards. Thenceforth, each of the enormous number of ships from the many countries sailing in every ocean became, quote, a temple of science, unquote. Maury's new charts were revolutionary. They allowed ship captains to shave weeks and months from the voyages and helped transform ocean navigation from an art to a science. Here was a new level of understanding that seafarers did not even know was there. And as one grateful captain wrote to him, quote, until I took up your charts, I had been traversing the oceans blindfolded, unquote. In turning data into shared knowledge, Maury invented the discipline of oceanography, and the practical implications were immense. Safer and more efficient sea travel was now available to any captain anywhere in the world who chose to use the new charts. The expenses of ocean commerce, from shipping costs and insurance to the prices of seaborne products and commodities, were all reduced, and the nations and the world's economies benefited accordingly. Innovation in the service of society is as American a tradition as democracy itself. So too are the benefits that so often spring from the public-private partnership. Lieutenant Maury taught the shipping industry how to work with the oceans. Franklin Roosevelt's rural electrification program transformed the American South, and scores of regional economies blossomed. Kennedy gave us Apollo, and by extension, all the technologies and advances that spun from it. And recently, the Human Genome Project, inspired by a significant government investment, has borne astonishing fruit. Last month, our president-elect made clear his intentions to act. And if our nation's leadership inspires American innovation, it may now be within our power to ensure that our responses to the coming climate changes are not merely reactive, but are proactive. The climate changes that crest the horizon may be beyond our immediate control. How we choose to meet them is not. Thank you very much.
Time for a couple questions if we've got some in the audience. Go ahead, please. And if you could identify yourself, and we'll bring a microphone up too.
Great. Thank you, sir. Brian Bender with the Boston Globe. Secretary Gates writes in a new article in Foreign Affairs that he believes the defense industry, but also the Congress, the Pentagon bureaucracy, remains too wedded to conventional weapon systems. And many of these conventional weapon systems obviously rely on fossil fuels to an enormous extent. I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about the defense industry's perspective on how the U.S. military, which is so reliant on fossil fuels that obviously contribute to global climate change, how the defense industry can begin to help the military build a future force that does not rely on those fossil fuels and is much more climate friendly.
That's a good question. I'm probably not the best expert for that, but I'll make a couple of observations. One is the defense industry's use of fossil fuels is a mere iota of that which is being used. Secondly, we have historical precedents where you have examples of coal-fired ships and a major decision made 1912, 1913 by the British Navy, correspondingly by our Navy, to move toward oil. It was a big issue, by the way, in Britain because there was a domestic coal industry in Wales that had to be protected, and there was a view that good old Welsh coal was better than relying upon foreign oil. But in fact, the British Admiralty, I think it was Winston Churchill actually, saw this as something he had to do, and in fact, over time, it turned out it was superior technology. Our own Navy, of course, moved to nuclear power, which was very, very important, certainly for certain classes of warships, not necessarily for all. It's a tough problem. The cost of operating with fossil fuels is high. If you think about steaming hours, flying hours, it's an enormous amount of issue. The question is, what are the alternatives, and how do you get alternatives that still give you strategic advantage? It's not clear to me that in the near term there are substantial, significant alternatives to the use of fossil fuels. The United States Air Force has been working with other kinds of fuels, as you know, and has run experiments. At this point in time, I don't see a significant breakthrough. There have been discussions about moving all surface combatants above a certain tonnage to nuclear. That has certain advantages in terms of recurring costs. It has enormous costs in terms of non-recurring costs. So there are no simple solutions to this. I'm not sure I have any magic elixir to offer you.
One on the front there. Here we go.
Yeah, please.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Cheryl Pellerin from the State Department's America.gov website. When you were talking about the regional decision support centers, the tsunami warning centers sprung to mind, yeah. NOAA's warning centers. And I was wondering if you saw the regional decision support centers as international undertaking, and if those are the kind, if that's a similar concept.
Yeah, well, certainly. Let me just say that was an example and a notional one, but one could certainly see that tsunami warning centers networked. You could certainly see hurricane centers on our own coastlines as being part of that. I think that the point is that we now have significant amounts of data we never had before. And so the question is, how do you use that in a way which gives you both long-term prediction capability when you decide where to put a bridge or a road, or what do you decide to build on a shoreline, or perhaps nearer-term concern about actual events that might happen this season, this winter? Are we really going to have to worry about stocking up on fuel oil because it's going to be the coldest winter we've ever seen? There's no reason why it couldn't be an international thing. I think it's something that the United States is probably the only country that could take the lead in actually creating, and I think once it gets created, it's sort of like an oyster pearl. You know, you put the grain of sand there, and then eventually if it's a good thing, it'll become global.
We had one on the other side. If you
yeah.
still have time for a couple more.
Dr. Sugar, hi. Jim Wolf, Reuters.
Hi, Jim.
You made the very important points about the huge potential payoff of any such initiative for society and the world. But may I ask you about how Northrop Grumman itself might stand to benefit? CSIS, I believe, has called for doubling the amount the U.S. government spends on Earth observation, from about $2.5 billion a year to $5 billion. Is that a potential market for Northrop Grumman, and can you explain how so?
Yeah, Jim, let me just say that the answer is yes. It's something we're interested because it's a place we can contribute, and obviously there's a business opportunity with that, and that's the way our capital system works. If you look at our history, Northrop has been in the business of Earth monitoring, Earth sensing for five or six decades now, including some of the very earliest satellites that were built for this purpose, and more recently some of the larger, more complex satellites, Aqua, Aura. We're working on InPost now and others. We're also involved in ground processing. So we do see an opportunity for the company. And more importantly, though, I think we see an opportunity to take a core of expertise and capability that exists within the human talent of the company and apply to this problem. It's not exactly the same as the situational awareness problem of the military. It's not exactly the same as the command and control problem. There's different time constants, different degrees of complexity, different constituents. But even though the words are not exactly the same, it rhymes. And it feels like something that we can actually help work on. And secondly, from a company standpoint, it does involve a security issue. As we said, that the climate change and the impacts of climate change are in fact an underlying security issue for the nation and the world. And that's sort of what we have to be concerned about. So if you think about the way we approach our marketplace, Jim, it's we think about a global security in its broadest context and where can we take skills that we have and apply them there. And that's why we have a lot of interest in this problem.
And just as a follow-up, can you put a number on how much of your revenues are now derived, or how much revenue Northrop Grumman currently derives from this
gosh, I don't have a number at the tip of my fingers, probably a few percent today. It could grow.
Overall, of
the revenues, yeah, a few percent, yeah, perhaps. And of civil-related work, I wouldn't say it's all climate. And it could certainly grow. I think it all depends upon the need. And I think there is a need here. I think that we're looking at something which is really hard. This is a hard problem, but it's not necessarily any harder than the Manhattan Project was, or the ICM project, ICBM, or the Apollo project. And the question is, do we think as a nation there's a payoff here, and should there be an initiative? And if there is, if it's a hard problem, we ought to put our smart people to work on it. We ought to fund it. There ought to be a policy, and there ought to be some continuity of interest.
And for those of you in the back, there's a few seats up in the front. This isn't like church, and we won't ask you to sing or anything. So, if there are no more questions, one more. Can we get time? One more, and then that's it.
Nancy Colleton with the Alliance for Earth Observations. Could you please describe how NPOSE fits into the vision that you discussed with us this morning?
Well, NPOSE is certainly an extraordinarily important element of that. It is one of a whole number of orbiting sensors, and, of course, there's more than just orbiting sensors. This will be a very, very capable machine with multiple sensors and the ability to do a whole bunch of observations. This will gather a substantial body of additional knowledge, additional information. It'll have a lot of benefit for weather, for climate monitoring. It'll be valuable for the Department of Commerce, obviously. That's why NOAA has been the lead of this thing. It's commercially important. It'll be important for scientific reasons, which is one of the reasons NASA is involved. And, oh, by the way, it'll be very important for our military, and that's why the Air Force is involved. So important program and something that I think the nation is going to be very happy to have as we get this thing orbiting in the next few years. Okay? All right. Thank you all.
Great. Thank you. Great speech. Now on the agenda. Hi, my name is Jim Lewis. I work at CSIS. We're going to turn to our panel of experts, which is another part of this I've really been looking forward to. It will be led by Sarah Ladislaw, who's a fellow here at the Energy and National Security Program. Sarah was invaluable in getting this set up, and she is, in fact, our climate change guru here at CSIS. So I'm grateful that she's taking some time. She worked at the Department of Energy, and she was a Presidential Management Fellow, which we all know is sometimes the cream of the crop there in the old federal service. So grateful that you're willing to do this. She will introduce the panelists, and that gets me off the hook. Your turn.
Thanks, Jim. Good morning. My name is Sarah Ladislaw. I'm a fellow here in the Energy and National Security Program, and it's great to see so many of you bright and early on a Friday morning. I'm consistently amazed by the crowds that we've been drawing here at CSIS over the last couple years dealing with climate change and energy issues, which are the two issues that I deal with. I think it really speaks to the level of interest that we've seen. I guess next month will mark my two-year anniversary here at CSIS, and I, like many foolish people that come into think tank land, thought that I would be able to leave the federal government and come over to a think tank and kick my feet up and think big thoughts and leisurely read through the news and sort of just spend my time trying to gather my thoughts. And it's actually been quite the opposite. I think that part of that is sort of good timing on my part, but over the last several years, we've been going around town and the world really talking about how we see global energy trends developing, how we see sort of the demand for energy grow precipitously in new parts of the world, how that's had an impact on geopolitics and policy going forward, on prices, on markets. How policymakers view energy systems and how companies respond, how you and I in our daily lives choose to use energy or not use energy or do things differently. And I think that climate change and the growing awareness of the impact that it has on the natural environment and the impact that our energy production and use has on the climate all sort of are part of this message that is resonating so deeply across sectors. And so one of the things that's been nicest for me here at CSIS is that in all of the programs here, climate change and global change in general has been an issue of growing importance. No longer can we talk about energy trends without talking about security, without talking about water, without talking about agriculture, without talking about sort of the way the world around us is changing. And so I think that is why events like this one, where I am not an Earth observation expert by any stretch of the imagination, are so exciting for me and sort of do fit into my ideal of what I should be doing here at a think tank. So it's my great pleasure to be here with three experts that we've brought together who do know a lot more about some of these issues than I get to work on in my day-to-day life. I think today we're going to focus on climate change, the security impacts of climate change, how a lot of what Dr. Sugar and some of the things that we're going to talk about this morning fit into the larger conversation about climate change that Dr. Hamry was alluding to in his opening remarks. So I look forward to sort of a robust discussion. I think I'm going to introduce the panelists one at a time and go in alphabetical order, and if everyone's okay with that. I'm going to start first with Sharon Burke. Sharon's a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security, and she's an expert on energy, climate change, and the Middle East. She was former senior policy advisor and director at the National Security Project for the Third Way. She's former a member of the policy planning staff of the Department of State and special assistant to the Deputy Secretary of State, Richard Armitage, who also worked on our Smart Power Initiative here at CSIS. So, Sharon.
Thank you, Sarah. I should also point out that I spent all of my formative years working in the Department of Defense, was there for 7 years, so a lot of what I have to say comes out of more directly out of that experience and knowing that community a little bit, just enough. It was really interesting to listen to Dr. Sugar talk about all of the data and all of the information and this wealth of data that we have available, and then the fact that it's not being used. So I was asked to talk about national security and this wealth of data and Earth observations and why is it not being used. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that, but a very important one is that there's no demand signal, right? Your customer is not giving you a demand signal. And why is that the case? Again, a number of reasons, but let me give you one. The Joint Forces Command, which I'm sure most of you are aware, was originally founded to be the very innovative, forward-looking part of the military and to help all the forces figure out how to look into the future and collaborate as a one force. Well, they just came out with their Joint Operating Environment Statement, and this is what it had to say. It had two paragraphs on climate change, and this is supposed to be the forward-looking, what are the challenges of the future. This is one of the paragraphs. The impact of global warming and its potential to cause natural disasters and other harmful phenomena, such as rising sea levels, has become a prominent and controversial national and international concern. Some argue that there will be more and greater storms and natural disasters, others that there will be fewer. In many respects, scientific conclusions about the causes and potential effects of global warming are contradictory. Okay, for those of you who work in this in the Earth observations field, you know that's not true. There's certainly a lot of questions about what's going to happen where and when and other level of resolution. But the fact that this is happening, there's no scientific debate on that anymore. And the fact that the innovators in the military are putting out a document right now that says that should be a cause for concern. That's why you're not getting a demand signal. Now, that's not a blanket statement that no one in the U.S. military thinks this is a problem. I know for a fact that there are people in the Navy, some of whom are in this room, who not only believe this is a problem, but are trying to plan against requirements for how you deal with it. And if you consider that a lot of people in the Navy have to live with the actual changes, they're out there in the undersea environment, and they're out there watching the Arctic and the ice, and they know what's happening. So there are a lot of people in the military who don't need convincing. But in general, I think it's fair to say that there are a lot of people who do need convincing. So why is that, and what do you do about it? You're talking about a very large institution, and when you're talking about conceptual, cultural, and organizational change for new missions, it's not easy to accomplish. It does require better information, which is where the Earth observing systems come in. But you're also going to have to enter the conversation at a lower level because, again, you've got to start with the understanding that most people in the U.S. military do not accept that this thing is happening, let alone that it means new missions for them. Now, when you talk about conceptual change, this is happening because we're talking about a broader problem, not just about climate change. The notion of warfare and how we fight wars is changing. And I think a good case in point of that is just on Monday, Gordon England signed a new Department of Defense Directive 3000.07, which recognizes irregular warfare as equal to conventional warfare, that they are now the same. That's explicitly what it stated. So I think what you have to take that as is a sign that that there's a vast conceptual and cultural change going on in the department, changing the understanding of what the American way of war is. This is not an easy change. It's going to take some time. The problem is, of course, that we don't have time because we happen to be in arguably a three-front war right now that is a different kind of war that we have to fight, and we've been having trouble fighting it. I would say that how we look at climate change and climate change missions is all part of this larger conceptual change that's very painful, that's going on in a department that's very stretched. I mean, we have to cut people some slack in the sense that it's very hard to fight a war and plan for the future at the same time, and we have a relatively small military for doing those things. If you look at it this way, climate change is the 21st century mission, and there's no question in my mind, and I'm sure in the mind of most people in this room, that is going to be defining our missions for the 21st century. But today, our military, and especially our land forces, are completely engaged in 20th century warfare, right? We've been, since the end of World War II, the U.S. military has one of its main missions has been protecting access to strategic commodity, to oil. We've been protecting sea lanes and protecting the stability of these countries, including through two hot wars. That's been, the latter half of the 20th century, the military's mission. Moving away from that and redefining what your mission is going to be, particularly when you're still fighting those 20th century wars, is not going to be an easy change. But, you know, one of the things, and I think our colleague from the Boston Globe asked a very leading question on this, which is that we have to turn the concept on its head. You know, the other part of the Joint Operating Environment statement that was really interesting was about oil and how we're just going to be dependent on oil for the foreseeable future. And, you know, they even go as far to say the central problem for the coming decades will not be the lack of petroleum reserves, but rather a shortage of drilling platforms, engineers, and refining capacity. See, this is fatalism, right? We're saying that we're all dependent on oil and coal, and that's just the way it is, and, you know, too bad. And I think that's only an acceptable answer if you really don't believe in climate change, and if you believe there are no consequences 30 years out to ramping up your consumption and your emissions. Because if you do believe in it, it's just not an acceptable answer. So you have to figure out how we can turn that concept on its head from fatalism to this is just the hand we're dealt to how do we change it. And again, that's not easy. I'm a pragmatist. You know, we're talking about a global financial crisis that could be the worst that, you know, my 86-year-old father-in-law may even recognize the signs of this in the depression he lived through. He seems to be. So our ability to deal with this is going to be constrained. There's no question about that. But we don't have a choice. And that's one of the things I think you see in the military community is the sense that we have a choice, that we can choose not to go through global warming or climate change. And we need to figure out a way to turn that concept on its head. So when you're talking about all this wonderful data you have, and I think that Dr. Sugar made an excellent point about that we need decision quality data, it's got to go a step further than that. You need to be demonstrating for people in the military that this phenomenon is real and true and observed. You bring your rhetoric down a level and understand that we still have a first step to go through. And I think I want to talk about four things I think need to happen, and some of which are already well underway. But one is we've got to develop a mutually intelligible language between science and national security. It's not there right now. We don't know how to talk to each other, and we should be natural allies in this, particularly since the military procures billions and billions of dollars on threats that are not provable, right? We're procuring for weapons platforms for 20, 30, 40 and installations years in the future based on threat perceptions today and what we think is going to happen. We should be able to put climate change into that basket. This is the way the military works. They look ahead in long time frames, and they procure a lot of money based on threats that they are analyzing and thinking about in future terms. So this should not be impossible. But science, I think, one of the things I've found, and I'm obviously not a scientist, I'm an English major, even worse, is that one of the problems is that for perfectly good and understandable reasons, you have to be very careful about how you express observations because our information changes and we can't always interpret it correctly. But you're going to have to find a way to express that uncertainty in different terms. Because, again, the military is fine with uncertainty. But when you say we don't really know anything, they can't procure against that. So we've got to find a mutually intelligible language that allows us, that allows the military to give you the demand signal you need to move forward with these systems. Secondly, we need a leadership change, and that's happened. So I think that if – I just talked to Jim Conaton last week, and I think if he were sitting up here, he's the head of the Council on Environmental Quality, he would say this administration did a lot on climate change and moved the ball forward. I think there are a lot of people who would argue with that. At the very least, the only energy strategy that this administration put out in 2001 was a very status quo document that basically said there are a lot of things we can do and that we should do and that we will do, but we really have to figure out how to use more oil and drill at home. And that was the central message of that strategy was status quo, right? So this administration, I think, had doubts about the science that it expressed in the very beginning. And if they changed their minds at some point, it was that initial expression of doubt and of status quo that never went away. So the leadership signal, demand signal, leadership signal, hasn't been there. The National Command Authority has not said this is something you need to take seriously and look at. So it's understandable that the military has not done so. Why should they? Right? You don't win points for getting out ahead of your National Command Authority. So we now have a president-elect who's made a point in his transition, as Dr. Sugar pointed out, in his transition of reaffirming some campaign promises in this area, which are, again, in the current circumstances, going to be very hard to follow through on. But he's made it clear he intends to, even though he knows now that the circumstances have changed in terms of money that's available and even just that oil prices have fallen. So the sense of urgency is gone for the American public. He's still made it clear he's going to follow through. So the leadership is there. And I do hope that more than our stolid friends from the Navy understand that that's the commander-in-chief they have now and that this joint operating environment statement is out of line with their new commander-in-chief. So I do hope you'll see that change. And in turn, you've got to reach out and empower the people in the U.S. military who are looking at things differently. And one of the ways, and I'm really delighted that we have Anna here today, because one of the ways that that's already happened is that there have been some really helpful legislative changes. One of them was that the Quadrennial Defense Review, the National Defense Strategy, and the National Military Strategy this time around are required to look at climate change as a security challenge. Now, the National Defense Strategy that just came out did that in an extremely perfunctory way. So you could say they met the letter of the law. They certainly didn't meet the spirit. That's all right. I mean, again, we're talking about we're having a massive change in leadership here. But going forward, they will have to take it more seriously. Now, one of the things that's really encouraging about that is that requirement has effectively created a new intellectual infrastructure in the department. So you have in OSD policy planning, you have people who are focusing on this issue. Unfortunately, the gentleman that's focusing on it, who's really got the right mix of skills, the policy expertise and the technical expertise, is going to be shifted to another assignment, which is really unfortunate. But still, the infrastructure is being built in the services, and it's different in the joint staff in each of the services. In the Navy, it's in the N8. They're looking very closely at how to incorporate these concerns into the QDR. So what it's effectively done has created a new intellectual infrastructure in the department for how to look at these issues, which I think is very encouraging and is a network that can be tapped to help propagate understanding of these issues. And then finally, I really liked what Dr. Sugar had to say about practical applicability. We did a war game this summer on climate change where we brought in some international players to play a futures game on what happens. And one of the things that was interesting in building all the scenarios for the futures is that there's just great gaps in our knowledge and of the kind of knowledge you need as a military planner if you're going to try to plan against this. So, for example, we should be able to tell where people are most likely to be moving, right? We should be able to tell from observations, although I know there are some giant gaps in Africa, for example, in coverage, but we should be able to tell where there's likely to be, based on trend lines, droughts and other conditions that are going to hurt agriculture that may force people to move. We should be able to tell, and we certainly have the data on in the past where the storm trends are showing us we may have a problem. We should be able to make some pretty good observations about where people are likely to move and where they might go and how likely it is that they're going to return. You know, and I just in closing, in Jim's wonderful report, one of the things that really struck me is it made the case about the links between climate change, effects on human societies, migration, and conflict. I think just as people who work in this area, as a common sense matter, you could say, of course that's going to happen. Look at a place like Somalia, where you have a weak and failing state that's also saddled with terrible drought conditions and famines, and people are moving in large numbers. It's increasingly lawless. It's the, you know, the combination of these factors has led to not only, you know, a failed state, but also military missions for the U.S., right? We're conducting missions against al-Qaeda positions in Somalia, and also now against piracy, which is rather extraordinary in what they're able to do, a different kind of asymmetric or irregular warfare, right? Well, we can all say, yeah, that's going to happen or it's happening, but as a matter of fact, we do not have the observations and the data to back that up. Can we say that these things all lead to conflict conditions? No, we cannot. We don't have good empirical observations to back that up. And again, it's going to be very hard to get planners to move on this and to actually procure against it. If you want to double that budget, that's fine. But right now, they don't see the point in that because you haven't provided anything to them along those lines that they can actually use. So the practical application of the data is going to be very important going forward. And I would encourage everybody who's in the Earth observing community to think about that and about that you have to create a community of users and you have to help us generate that demand signal. We have a long way to go, but it's very exciting that all these people are here in the room together having this conversation. And to me, that's a very hopeful thing. So I'm grateful to be a part of it. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharon. Always very interesting comments and good perspective. You know, I failed to mention before you spoke that the Center for New American Security and the Center for Strategic and International Studies last year, we both failed to mention, did a study on the impacts, the security impacts of climate change. And what struck me or reminded me to bring it up was sort of your point about sort of oftentimes the mitigation side or the fatalism over how difficult it is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the current energy system often sort of throws the conversation in the wrong direction, which when we looked at sort of the security impacts of climate change on a best case scenario and asked significant, you know, sort of thought leaders, people who'd been involved in politics, who are general, you know, scholars on society and social development, to look at what the potential implications would be for security, for our well-being as a society, the situation was pretty dire. And when you looked at the worst-case scenario, which we had someone who could really think outside the box to do that, the mention that energy and climate mitigation got at that state of the game was virtually negligible. The problems were that bad. I mean, it was really sort of a very sobering conversation. So I think maybe that's why people don't start there, because when you look at sort of the security impacts first, it can be a pretty daunting conversation. And it does get directly to the issue that you're talking about of how well equipped we are to take in information like that and do something productive with it. So our next speaker, Dr. Andrew Cohen, is the Deputy Chief of Staff on the Select Committee for Energy Independence and Global Warming. Before she was on the Select Committee, she was the Director for Environmental Policy at the Center for American Progress, and we're grateful to have you here today.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. I appreciate the invitation from CSIS and also that you're covering this issue. It's one that doesn't get as much attention in D.C., and I think it deserves more. In the last Congress, the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming was created by Speaker Pelosi to draw attention to these two intertwined and very critical policy areas, both for our national security and international peace and prosperity. And we think we did a pretty good job over the last couple of years. We had over 50 hearings, including our very first, which looked at the national security impacts of these issues, and also one this summer joint with Representative Eshoo's subcommittee in the Intelligence Committee after the National Intelligence Assessment on this issue came out. And I, when we get back to interacting a little bit, I'll be curious to hear from Sharon what impact she thought the NIA has had on the security and defense community here in D.C. Dr. Finger testified before the committee, and his public testimony, at least, was very interesting and I thought very powerful. And I hope that that is helping change some mindsets. And I'm told the classified version, which I can't read, was better. So, and I'm also very pleased that the speaker recently announced that it was her intention to recreate the Select Committee in the next Congress. So we hope to continue doing our work on these two issues in a cross-cutting way, which we're sort of uniquely able to do because we don't have sort of the jurisdictional boundaries that the standing committees have to deal with. We also, just to plug the committee a little bit more, we have we did write a report wrapping up our 2 years of work, and that's available on our website at globalwarming.house.gov. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that. I'd also like to echo Dr. Sugar's point about data overload. I am trained as a climate scientist and as a graduate student in the late 90s. I found it hard to stay abreast of the latest climate information coming out, and that's just become worse over my years now working in D.C., and it's practically impossible, even though it's a very important part of my job at the Select Committee. So there's no doubt that the scientific enterprise is working very hard to elucidate this challenging problem. And now we do, I'm in agreement with Dr. Sugar, need to really focus on how we move forward in designing decision-making tools that will help everybody from the federal government right down to local and business leaders make their decisions going forward. We are, I'm happy to say, poised to move climate legislation in the next Congress, and I'm optimistic about that. Even despite the economic challenges that we are facing, I think both the congressional leadership and the president-elect views our energy and climate policy as a way to drive economic growth, to create new jobs, to create new industries. Certainly, our allies in Europe have used their climate and energy policies in the last few years to drive the development of these industries that are going to be very important in the coming decades. And where China's focusing on it, the Japanese, it's a very competitive marketplace, and it will behoove us to use domestic policy to drive the development of those issues. And climate legislation and policymaking is actually relatively unique in the world of policymaking in that it's driven by scientific observation. We wouldn't be dealing with this problem if it weren't for the decades of work of the scientific community to show that humans are, in fact, changing the climate of the Earth, and that that has really serious and dramatic impacts. And probably many scientists think it's taken policymakers a little too long to catch on to what the science has been saying, but we are now there. And the question that policymakers are having to grapple with is, how quickly is this going to happen? What are the impacts going to be? How do we design policy to deal with that? You can't work for Chairman Markey without keeping in mind the words of Tip O'Neill that all politics is local. And so for members of Congress, what motivates them is what's going to happen to their constituents. And I think if you look across the United States, in the in the regions where climate, where states have come together to start working on climate, whether it's the West, the Northeast, even the Midwest, it's because they're seeing impacts that they know are incredibly serious for their state. So out west, there's wildfires, there's droughts, there's declining snowpack. In the Northeast, there's warming winter temperatures, there's bigger storm surges, there's rising sea levels. In the Midwest, they're looking at their agriculture production being challenged by massive floods and droughts. And so everybody is, these impacts are sort of focusing everyone's attention. And what policymakers need is to understand that much better at a much granular level than we can right now. And so I just want to lay out a few points from my legislative perspective, making the case for why we need an investment in these observations and the science behind them and the development of decision-making tools even more than we ever have. And one is, as we push to incorporate more renewable energy in our electricity system, and especially the intermittent sources of wind and solar, are the people who run our electric grids need better forecasts to in order to balance out their demand and control the grid. And, you know, that is increasing the use of renewables is a bipartisan agreement. And, you know, we're moving forward on that. But we need to bring along the tools that will help integrate those resources into our traditional electrical grid better. And one of those is better weather forecasting. The other, and this gets a little bit more at the national security point, is there are some big questions, big climate questions out there, not whether it's happening or not, but on some of the impacts that we still don't fully understand, that we're not set up to monitor very well, but could have, they're sort of the high catastrophe probability type of things. Like if we lose the ice in Greenland very rapidly, what does that mean for sea level rise domestically and internationally? What does it mean for our Navy ports that are built in coastal environments, for some of our nuclear power plants that are on the edge of oceans? You know, is this uptick in methane in the atmosphere that we've seen over the last year because we're gearing up for a massive release of methane from the Arctic tundra, understanding that? And you all can probably pick your favorite tipping point and know that there's still a lot we don't know about those. So we need to focus on focus some real intense research and monitoring on these questions so we have a better handling of that. The also most pieces of climate legislation that are floating around, and I expect that any new legislation that's moving forward next year includes a sort of periodic review of the science in order to make sure the policy is sort of in line with what we understand about the Earth and what we understand the policy is doing. So we need the tools to support those periodic reviews. I think there's a role to play in the international climate negotiations and whatever agreement evolves, hopefully in the next year, to incorporate observation and monitoring as a way to meet some of the questions about reductions being achieved, avoided deforestation, those type of things. We've had other international agreements that have incorporated to some degree scientific monitoring as a way of not of enforcing exactly, but of supplementing the agreements. And I think that, again, in the climate area, that's a role that could be played. And finally, understanding the domestic and international impacts for adaptation issues, as well as the security issues. And I mean, Sharon spoke very well about it, but if you think about any of the sort of international hotspots in the world right now, there's very likely a climate impact that makes that conflict worse. And one that I think about a lot is the Tibetan Plateau. Most of the major rivers in Asia rise from the glaciers there. It's one of the parts of the world that is warming the most rapidly. And water is obviously a huge issue for China, India, and Pakistan, all of whom have nuclear weapons and somewhat tense relationships with each other. That's probably an understatement at the moment. So, that's just one example of an area. And so, again, better understanding and adaptability to lead us to decisions that will able to mitigate that and deal with those going forward is going to be really crucial to international peace and prosperity.
Great. Thanks, Anna. I think maybe during the discussion session we'll talk a little bit more about what you mentioned about sort of the U.S. role for leadership on this issue in the international climate negotiations, since those are currently underway. Our next speaker is Dr. William Hook. He's a senior policy fellow at the American Meteorological Society, where he directs the policy program. Research interests include natural disaster reduction. And in a former incarnation, he was the director of the U.S. Weather Research Program Office and the deputy chief scientist and acting chief scientist of NOAA. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah. And I will try to move things along so we have a good time for discussion. I've got 4 points that I'd like to hit. The first concerns the pervasive effects of climate change on national security. And you've heard from the previous speakers, from Sharon and from Anna, some of that picture. The trick is to remember that climate change or global warming is not 1/10,000th of a degree of warming per day for 30,000 days, but the presentation of climate change is something quite different. The Earth system does its business in large part through extreme events, and these are highly localized. So when we talk about a global change in temperature or a global change in precipitation, we are talking about changes in patterns of extremes. We are not doing very well coping with the current pattern of extremes. Our losses due to natural disasters are rising more rapidly than the world's economy is growing. And so we have a big challenge to sort out there. You also heard Anna and Sharon talk a little bit about environmental issues, about melting of the permafrost, the melting of the glaciers and sea level rise and these rather direct consequences. But I think arguably the greatest challenge from a security standpoint is not these direct impacts themselves, but our societal response to them. Think of it as something analogous to an autoimmune response in our bodies, where it's not so much whatever the agent was, it's sort of our reaction to it. 9/11 was a good example of that, I think, that here we had an enormous and tragic event, but its consequences were greatly overshadowed by the subsequent U.S. And worldwide reaction to it. And all of the actions and decisions and the kinds of policy efforts and so on that have been made in the succeeding 7 or so years. If you you can see other examples of this. More recently, we've seen a trend towards renewable energy, particularly in the form of biofuels, and the combination of that with corn subsidies led to a sort of price rise of grains worldwide, and that then led to a shutting down of international trade in grains. And so the connectedness of water and agriculture and energy use and the environment is ricocheting through the way our world works in ways that we're poorly prepared to cope with. So climate change is not sort of showing up on a blank slate. It's going to aggravate all sorts of pre-existing stresses, as Anna and Sharon have indicated. So if you look at mitigation, for example, we know that already the greenhouse gas emission issue is contentious between the countries that are developing versus the countries that have. If you turn to adaptation, you find the same kind of tension internationally. Are the rich countries going to be more successful at adapting to climate change than the poorer ones, and so on? And one word we haven't heard yet so far today is geoengineering. We have arguably something like a dozen countries that are unilaterally capable of making substantial changes to the environmental regime. And those actions are, in the scheme of things, maybe relatively cheap to some of the other actions or costs of inaction that we might look at. So all of these things create a need for a lot better understanding, a lot better formulation of policy and understanding of those issues. Dr. Sugar, I thought, talked extremely eloquently about the case for bringing technology to bear here, and he said something which I thought was pretty generous, and this is probably, I think Northrop Grumman said this, but it could have been ITT or Raytheon or SAIC or Lockheed Martin. The whole community would be voicing this kind of idea that, hey, we've made a big investment in these other arenas. We can apply it here. But I think that may lead us to believe that the technology and the science are much more in hand than they are really. So I want you to think about the difference between answering a very simple science question, is climate change real? A very simple science question is, did human beings play some role in that? And the question of what to do about it, and particularly when what to do about it includes not just the CO2 off switch, but also adaptation measures. And you remember what I said about the Earth system. It's doing its business through highly localized, acute, extreme events. So the observing system, the decision support systems that he talked about, they have to be capable of a kind of global coverage on the one hand, and this very detailed resolution in space and time, and this very sharp kind of connection between the physical environment and these societal impacts, that's a lot of science. And then if we look at geoengineering, I think all of, particularly in the science community, that genie has sort of been let out of the bottle. People know that that's something they can try, but the potential for unintended consequences and so on places huge demands on science going forward. So the biggest mistake we can make in this area is trying to solve tomorrow's problem with yesterday's science and technology. Okay. Now, there's a kind of science that hasn't been brought up here very much, except it's been implicit in Sharon and Anna's comments. I just mentioned the technological challenge of getting the global observing infrastructure and the communications and the modeling and so on in shape. That's formidable, and it will require more dollars. But we lack the analytical foundation for knowing where to place those bets. We do not have a foundation in the economics of these adaptation efforts and so on, where we can say this will provide a high return on investment That won't. Our ability to do triage, we can save this ecosystem, but we can't save that one. These decisions require a whole set of science, not just economics, but social science. How do we deal with public good issues? How do we deal with the effects of poverty and so on this? How do we deal with the non-monetizable aspects of this? The economic value of these different efforts and these technologies and so on, difficult to measure, but they're not fundamental physical constants. They, in turn, depend on the kind of policy framework that's governing the decision. So all of this feeds in to a security context, and all of it means that we're not investing in this technology right now. We are making allocations based on what we spent last year and how much money we have left over this year. And, oh, by the way, we have a whole bunch of emergencies we haven't contemplated. So maybe let's try to delay that investment a little bit. That's the wrong kind of analytical foundation for making investments of this nature. And here's my final point. And that is that we're talking a lot about climate change today. But that is competing with a change that's far more rapid and far more important to this, namely societal change. The human race is on a roll. In a very short period of time, the span of a generation or two, we've greatly increased our numbers. We've greatly increased our resource use per capita. And we have accelerated greatly the rate of social change. And when we've accelerated social change, we have introduced new vulnerabilities to the environment in a time short compared with the time required for those vulnerabilities to show up. Whether it's we've tuned our success to a narrow range of climate conditions, and we have introduced new vulnerabilities to extreme events that occur on periods long compared, say, with the construction of levees or the introduction of a lot of space infrastructure that's vulnerable to space weather and so on. So we need policies that are far more adaptable. We need to get over a kind of divide that we've artificially created between the public and the private sector here. I think this financial difficulty, global financial difficulty of the last few months has really highlighted for all of us that private sector and public sector and the public are joined at the hip. So those are the challenges we face going forward. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was excellent. These have all been really interesting comments, and I definitely want to take some questions from the audience. But before we do that, I can't sort of resist the urge of asking a few questions of the group ourselves and having a little bit of a conversation. I think a lot of what we've heard is the notion that in a lot of ways, in dealing with climate change and societal responses to climate change, our knowledge doesn't quite fit the bill for what we're going to need to make the kind of decisions that we will. And really, the stance over the last several years or currently is that we're on our heels. And whether you think that's because of a political situation or the pace at which our understanding of these problems has been evolving over the last several years is sort of beside the point. But the question would be, so if we were to try and get off of our heels, right, if we were trying to create a U.S. leadership opportunity, as Dr. Sugar had sort of mentioned, how would we do that? And I guess I mentioned that in light of sort of the current environment. We've got a lot of climate negotiators over in Poland right now from around the world. Most of the media attention and political attention here focuses on the mitigation agreement aspects and not necessarily our efforts to improve our understanding of the world around us and how that feeds into our decision-making. So, and what would U.S. leadership on this issue look like? Should we be looking to the United States to be a leader in this way? Just some thoughts on what you think about that, or how much attention is this issue actually getting within those discussions? Anybody?
Do you want to go first?
No, you go first. Go ahead.
Well, I would say it's kind of a difficult question. I mean, the U.S. has been a leader in climate research. I think in over the last decade, especially our friends in Europe and Japan have seen this as a serious issue and invested more. And frankly, you know, some of the work that especially the U.K. Is doing on understanding the impacts and mitigation, and the greater European Union is also moving forward on that. I think we may be a little bit behind, but I mean, to give you one perspective, until Speaker Pelosi in the last Congress, we didn't discuss the words global warming for a whole decade in the House. And so it's hard to exert leadership on an issue if your legislative bodies aren't talking about it. I think despite that, the scientific community has continued to do their work. The states have picked up a lot of action. There's a lot of great – NOAA has a lot of great examples of the RESAs, which I always forget what it stands for, but it's basically a regional assessment that involves stakeholders from all over. I think we have an example of the 2000 national assessment where we looked at the impacts regionally and involved stakeholders from all areas, both government and private sector, to be involved with that and understand the impacts and some of the policy that would go along with that. And so hopefully, given the new leadership, we can dust off some of that work and, given what we've learned over the last decade, move forward quite rapidly. Obviously, the world is looking for U.S. leadership. I hope we'll be able to exert that and show that very quickly, and so that we can move forward as a globe on this global problem.
Okay, well, I think there are two aspects here. A couple of days ago, Resources for the Future and Molly McCauley had a session on a similar topic, and Nigel Purvis said something at that session that was salient. He said that the U.S. has to lead from a position of integrity, and that means sort of facing squarely this problem domestically, and I think all the speakers have emphasized that. We also should be doing this from a spirit of adventure. I liked what Ron was saying about, he went back in history a little bit and talked about the age of exploration and sort of how people work things through. I don't know about you all, but I'm kind of tired about hearing the folks in World War II being the world's greatest generation. I'd like us to be the world's greatest generation. And we have a chance. If we do this right, people, history will look and they'll say, you know, the turning point, the dawn of the 21st century was a turning point here, that scientists got their, we had these instruments and these technologies and these space platforms, and for the first time you could take the pulse of the planet. And there was this flowering of understanding, and it occurred just at a nick of time because 8 billion people were turning the planet into an ash can, you know. And they'll envy, you know, they're going to envy us, folks. They're going to envy Ron and Sharon and Sarah and so on. They're going to say, boy, it must have been exciting to live during that time because you had this sense of manifest destiny. You knew how this was going to work out. And they're going to say, it's not like today. Today, all we have is red tape and organizational squabbles and infighting and so on, and they're just not going to recognize what it was like now either.
I like that vision a lot. and I have two other observations in addition to the fact that, you know, of course, we're going to have to get our consumption under control at home if we're going to lead at all and have the ability to lead on, at least on the mitigation side. On adaptation, we will be a leader, whether we want it or not, because we are the only country that has the capabilities to respond to what's going to happen. And we have the strategic lift. We have, you know, the command and control systems that nobody else has. So we will be leading on adaptation response. There's no way around that. An interesting thing in this game that we did, one of the things that we were testing that was not transparent to the players was whether a dramatic change in U.S. leadership profile would change the nature of the negotiations, so that if the United States was really forward-leaning on these negotiations, would it matter? And it mattered to some extent, you know, but the question became, no, actually it depends on what China does. So U.S. leadership is not irrelevant, but at the end of the day, we're not actually going to be able to do anything unless we can deliver China. So U.S. leadership may to some extent be what we can do to help China help itself, which is going to be a really hard row to hoe. But so the leadership challenges may come in ways that we're not expecting as well, I think.
Bill, I've decided that you have to come to all of our events from now on because you're decidedly optimistic and inspiring, and I find a lot of...
Okay, I think I'm the realist here. Okay,
okay,
that's not optimism. It's realism. That's the way it's going to be.
And, you'll perhaps indulge me another second for staying on the politics of actually making these kinds of changes. You know, everything these days, we're in fact going to put out a report in January looking at how the new administration needs to balance energy security and climate change priorities. And we've gotten a lot of feedback that says you need to rewrite the majority of this to be viewed as a stimulus, because everything in the outset of the new administration is going to be viewed for its stimulative effects. And I sort of heard inherent in Dr. Sugar's remarks that there are some opportunities here and actual commercial opportunities. And the Earth Observation Report that was done by our colleagues here at CSI actually point out sort of how knowledge of the natural environment is turned into dollars. I mean, so if we really are talking about making an investment of about $5 billion in the system and probably more than that, can that be viewed, how does that match up with sort of near-term priorities for a new administration coming in? I mean, can it be argued on the stimulative effect? I mean, is that how we should be approaching this?
Well, I mean, just one thing to point out is there is, I think, nearly a quarter, it may be higher, of our economy that is influenced by weather-related events. And as Bill pointed out, that sort of disaster payment is getting bigger in proportion to our GDP. And so I think, you know, right there, just making the case that being able to improve our observations in order to help that part of our economy that is very weather dependent will help smooth things out. And as I pointed out in my remarks, as we move to an energy economy that has more renewables, we're going to need even more of that to help keep things moving smoothly. But I think there are kind of boots on the ground types of actions that we'll see from the congressional leadership and the president elect that help reduce our greenhouse gases. So increasing weatherization, that help build new low carbon energy sources. And I think, you know, that's what they're looking for. There are also some options. I mean, we have a huge, most major cities have a huge stormwater burden. And so there are things we can invest in our infrastructure. And I hope that we do it in a way with an eye towards our climate resilience going forward. But I think all of those things are in the mix. But obviously, we're in a challenging economic place. We need to put people to work. And I think there are opportunities of putting them to work in ways that also help our energy and climate situation.
Yeah, I think a key thing here is to remember that not all stimulus packages, not all infrastructure investments are equal. And in talking about the things we've been discussing, we have a very future-oriented kind of investment. The analog to getting these things right is trying to navigate the streets of Chicago with a street map of Detroit. And what we want, instead of flying blind into this problematic future, we want to be understanding the Earth system rules and how they work. So we have a chance here to do this right. Anna is absolutely correct. I think if you look at the domestic payback, the value of these observations and so on, they're enormous. But let's not forget the international piece of this, which brings us back to the security issue. This is a very inexpensive, very visible way to change the course of the entire world, to be a good neighbor, to build relationships, and to market science and technologies and products and services at the same time. And I'll just put in a quick plug here. I'm probably the only person in the planet who thinks this. And there's certainly a series of NOAA administrators who've been very frustrated by finding themselves in the Department of Commerce. But in principle, the Department of Commerce should be just the right place for this activity, so you can link the activity to the International Trade Administration, and you can take advantage of the Economic Development Administration, which tries to build the economies of communities and so on. Ghani can come up here and reject that in a few minutes.
I'm going to say now you're never going to invite me back, because I actually think it's a big problem. You know, whether it's American culture or political economic culture or just human nature, you're talking about, a front of the pipeline investment. We are a lot better at waiting for the problems to manifest and then dealing with them. And to convince people to invest in something that will prevent something they will never see is really hard. And right now, when people are going to be losing jobs, and worldwide you're going to see even more dire problems, it's going to be really tough. And I think the CSIS report did a really good service there in trying to make that link between, making an investment like this and what you get for it. And I would say that needs to actually be drawn out considerably, with much more specific examples of the kind that Anna was talking about, where, okay, so if you get, two 100-year floods in Illinois within 15 years, what did that cost you? And if you had known it was going to happen, what could you have done, and what would that have saved you? That we're going to have to see a lot more of that kind of analysis if you want to convince people that an investment that's that intangible is worth it. So I'm not optimistic unless we can do that, and that's hard to do. So,
just very quickly, that's an important point, because we don't do well with long-term things, and that is an argument for being sure we complement mitigation strategies with adaptation strategies. Global change is rapid onset compared with the time required for 6 billion people to agree on what to do. But adaptation efforts are underway now. I mean, the four of us could start a company. The 200 or 300 of us in the room could start a company. We could say, we're smarter than that outside world. Let's go do this, and we'll do well by doing good. So I think depending on the strategy, we get a much bigger, or the policy, we get a much quicker payoff.
I do think we have a couple minutes for some questions from the audience. So I'll just, Lawrence. And please wait for the microphone. And when you get it, please state your name and affiliation. And if you could put your question in the form of the question, we'd always appreciate that.
Lawrence Jones with the University of Washington, Riva. Excellent panel. I like all I've heard so far. Very interesting. One question I have is the issue of economics and climate change has been discussed. And what should we do to maintain the sense of urgency as the price of gas fluctuates? The average person in the street, once the price of gas reaches to like $1.75, doesn't care about climate change. In the summer, I was having climate change discussions with my nieces. When the price of gas was $4, so what can we do as a community to distill the urgency of climate change? Because as you said, there's a local component to policy making, and if politicians realize that their constituencies are aware of the risk involved with climate change, they might act in that direction. So, just your thoughts on how do we maintain that sense of urgency? Thank you.
Well, just in our work in the Select Committee over the last 2 years. I mean, we've seen it's critical to make the national security and homeland security arguments, and we've tried to push those forward, but also the economic arguments about creating new jobs. I mean, you know, what do your nieces want to be when they grow up? Maybe they want to run a company that's helping the community deal with the environmental impacts of climate change, or maybe they want to be a wind turbine engineer or something along those lines. I mean, that's what we have to go to Bill's point and put the vision out there of a new America and inspire the current generation and the up and coming generation with the ideas of, wow, I don't need to think about a job on an oil derrick. I can think about a job in a wind farm. Or maybe I don't need to think about following my dad into the auto industry, but I'm going to go build solar panels, because now Michigan and Ohio are the two states that build the most solar panels in America. So, you know, it's laying out that economic vision, as well as understanding the very serious consequences to the local communities that we've been trying to do, and which I think we all collectively need to do more of.
It's, you know, the easy answer, well, not easy, but as a policy person, if I put on my policy hat, I'd say, well, we need a gas tax, you know, obviously. However, having spent some time in the political world, that's the shortest political career in history. Is as soon as you advocate that, you're dead in the water. Do we have a president who's prepared to do that? I don't know. It would be nice if he would, but if he were to walk in the room and say, should I really do that right now? I'd say, no, don't do that right now. Because, you know, people are struggling and the lower gas prices is going to help. But it's definitely the crux of the problem, that the price of gas doesn't reflect the real cost. How do we get past that? We haven't figured it out in 35 years. But I think one way is what Anna alluded to, and it's a little self-serving for me to say this because I'm from a national security think tank, but one way is to frame it as a national security issue because it's price resistant. And if you look at public opinion polling, you know, people say, yeah, climate change is a problem, but what am I going to do about it? Nothing. You know, it's a low priority. But when you ask them about dependence on foreign oil, you get a very different response. And it may be that withstands price. One really hopeful poll, if you look over time and you graph price of oil against public opinion, you know, public opinion moves with price in a tango, except for once, and that was after 9/11. Right? Prices shot up, public opinion shot up, prices fell, and public opinion stayed high. People continued to see dependence on oil as a security threat. So I think there's a lot of room in there to exploit that. Maybe that's not a nice word to use, but to use that way that people understand this issue to get at, to make some changes that are price independent. So I think a security lens, as Anna pointed out, is a positive way. And it's truthful. It's not just manipulative. It is. I mean, our geostrategic situation is a huge vulnerability to us. So, what I would say we need to do is that we've got to divorce people's understanding of the risk from the price.
Yeah, and, you know, I just wanted to add one point to that is I think what you've also seen in this last election is that the American public, while you might ask them or poll them on very particular issues, there was a real sense that people know that the future of the U.S. economy is a big question, that there are natural changes in their environment, and they don't know what they're about. I mean, I think that Senator Boxer had a public mic day for all the senators to come talk about what they're hearing from their constituents on climate change. And all politics is local. You know, people were worried about not being able to duck hunt in places they used to duck hunt. I mean, really, you know, normal everyday things, and people recognize those changes in their environment. So I stood up because I can't see this whole half of the crowd. So
I have a comment which you may or may not wish to respond to, but it seems like we've been talking a lot today about deconstructing climate change and mapping it so that we can deal with it with practical knowledge. And I've so enjoyed all the speakers, but I do see representatives from the corporate, academic, government, scientific, and military communities, and it would be great as sort of a standard habit to just have humanitarian and development representatives on the panel so that we're not just talking to them after we have a flood or when we have a drought, but before.
Can I just make a point that, you know, there is some fabulous work being done in the humanitarian community, the Red Cross, Oxfam, are two that I know of and have worked with in the past. And I think they really help give us a sort of boots on the ground perspective for when we're talking about what we need to do at the federal level to support that.
Thank you. I'm Jane Leggett from the Congressional Research Service. And I'd like to ask a question. There's a big emphasis on space observations or observations and mapping and science, but a number of panels of the National Academies of Science and a lot of critiques have noted that there's also imbalance between the sciences or the physical natural sciences and the social sciences. And this comes up, for example, the Earth system models that are being built don't include humans in them, like human activities. And there's out of the $1.5 billion on climate change science, there's maybe a few million that goes into economics and human-related social sciences. And what does happen tends to go into the agencies that actually do the physical sciences. It's been noted that there is a disconnect between the users and the people doing the work. And I'm wondering, how do any of you see that? Do you see that being redressed? How would you suggest that that happen? Or do you not think it's necessary?
I think Jane brings up a great point. And that's why, as the third of the 4 points I was trying to make, I talked about the need for investments in a whole range of social sciences, including but not limited to economics. And I would also include policy analysis and policy research. What we need right now in the year 2008 is the analog to what we had 50-some years ago in the Vannevar Bush report, Science, the Endless Frontier. And he made the case that the country was in such a dire strait that it could no longer rely on cobbling together natural science and engineering on kind of an emergency basis. We needed a steady flow of investment in that area. And today, we need that same investment in the social sciences. As Jane indicated, that costs, it's social scientists require, they don't require ocean-going vessels. They don't ask to be put in orbit. They make a rich return. The sensitivity, the challenge is, it's very easy for a government to put money into nanotechnology, but when you put money into policy research, guess what? Some of that is going to be a critique of what you're doing. But we have to find a way to finesse the to deal with the conflict of interest question, provide some kind of firewall there, and the country needs to invest in more of this kind of analytical work. As I said, we need something like a Vannevar Bush push and something that would be a national social science foundation.
Just to follow up, I agree with Bill on the points he makes there. I mean, personally, I went from starting my career in D.C. sort of making the case of arguing for climate legislation from the scientific point of view, and then in the last couple of years of like, geez, do I need to go back to school and learn my economics better? Because the issue is certainly shifting to that, and we need the science and research to support that. I'd also say, analogous to Sharon's point about needing better communication between scientists and the national security, we need to improve that between the sort of physical science and the societal science. And just from my small experience both with climate modeling and economic modeling is that climate modeling, we're trying to model this really complex system, and we want to put as many complexities in there as we possibly can, although humans are very complex to put into a climate model, I would have to say. Economists tend to look to sort of how they can simplify their models in order to deal with the complexities of human society and economics. So bridging those two is going to be a challenge. But it's one we need to make an investment in. Certainly the Stern Review stirred that pot And there have since been responses from in America and Europe to what they propose there. But we need to continue to support that type of dialogue and get to a point where we can have decision-making tools that are both underpinned by physical science as well as an understanding of the social and economic sciences.
I think that's a great comment, observation, Jane, and it's one of the reasons that I was talking in terms of demand signals, because I do think that if the military wants the kind of information it needs in order to be able to plan future missions that we're going to have, they need to start asking for that information. I think that'll help when that starts to happen as well. So.
Questions and brief responses, I can take two, so right there.
Jack Leibowitz, special volunteer at NIH, retired from NIH, but still a special volunteer. Health has not been brought up in this conference, and I think it actually needs to be interrelated. if temperatures go up, the malaria zone will go up. In this country, as temperatures go up, Lyme disease will increase. Then there's the issue of biodiversity and losing. Possibly, it's been estimated 50,000, half the species on Earth could be lost because of temperature changes. So I think that what needs to be done, and it's a security issue too. So I think that health and I think even the National Institutes of Health have to be brought into the picture with climate change.
We totally agree that's a critical issue. Actually, that's another one on understanding the urgency. The public really relates to the health impacts of climate change, and that's another one we need to keep front and center. We had a hearing about it, and Mr. Markey's climate legislation and investing in climate action and protection, we included within the adaptation a real focus on helping our health agencies, both at the federal and state level, to deal with that. And I'm very pleased that the state health agencies have a statement on climate change. The CDC has been trying to do work on that issue as well, and so it's a very important point.
Hi, Steve Moran with Raytheon. Just a quick question
Steve Moran with Raytheon. Bill talked about flying blind in terms of, and there's been a lot of talk about the science and technology basis for moving forward with the decisions we have to make here. Back in the early 90s, in a political move, the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment was abolished. And so Congress has sort of been flying blind. Is there any thought about reestablishing something like that so that Congress has that kind of arm?
That's interesting. It would be great to hear Anna answer that, because she can answer about whether or not that's feasible. But that's actually where I started my career and left shortly before it was eliminated. OTA was a great organization that I think produced a lot of really good reports, but I think that the reasons that it was eliminated, it would always be vulnerable to elimination, because when you're giving Congress, some member of Congress, advice that he or she does not want to hear, you will always be vulnerable. So I think it was a wonderful organization and would love to see it recreated, but would caution that it's fan club has grown since its demise, let's put it that way.
Is that absence makes the heart grow fonder?
Yes.
One, Jane and her colleagues at CRS have filled in a very important gap in that respect. And the National Academies, CRS works on a little quicker time frame for purposes of Congress. But obviously the National Academy's work is critical to what we do. OTA still exists in authorization, so it could be rebuilt relatively quickly given a financial boost there. I really don't know how likely that is. But it certainly has its supporters. Certainly the congressional leadership and the president-elect have made clear that they want their policies to be informed by science, and I think they will all be taking a look at how they can get more scientific information into the policymaking arena as we move forward. Whether or not that will be in OTA or something like OTA is an open question.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. I mean, I think your larger point is right on, which is that the Congress especially still needs an honest broker to help them make calls on science. Who that's going to be, I don't know. It'd be nice to see OTA come back, but you know, not optimistic. But I think you're right that the function needs to be filled.
Thanks. Catherine Silverthorne with E3G. I thought Anna made an interesting point earlier about climate change policy being somewhat unique in that it's driven by the science. And I think that that is no longer so much the case in terms of how the debate is running on Capitol Hill. We're seeing a divergence between the developing science and what scientists are saying the emissions trajectories need to be to approach the problem and the level of ambition in terms of legislation on the Hill. And I was wondering if there's possibly a unique role here for those in the national security community, because this community has such a robust approach to risk analysis and risk management. Is there a role there for ensuring that the conversation in Congress looks not only at mitigating cost, which I think has become the most important factor, but tends to actually drive towards lower ambition in terms of emission reduction? So my question would be, do you think that the national security community could help in terms of ensuring that whatever policies we end up putting in place to address climate change are not only affordable, but actually effectively cross the thresholds we need to cross in order to mitigate the actual risk?
I do, and I think there's two answers to that. One is that the CNA put out a report in April 2007 that was the result of a military advisory board of 11 flag rank officers, retired officers, who said, hey, this is a national security threat, and we have to treat it that way. And I think for my community, for the national security community, that was a really important study and changed how people look at this. And I think, again, it can help change how the nation looks at it. At the same time, and this is definitely Anna's territory, but it may be that it's something she can't be quite as tactless about as I can be. The partisan differences on climate change have been so pronounced and so obvious that I think to some extent they've masked some deeper issues, which is that this is really a regional problem, not a partisan problem, and that different parts of the United States, for example, we've got 24 states that produce coal, I think 14 of them at significant levels, and 13 that produce corn ethanol. These are going to be big problems going forward on the cap and trade, no matter who is sitting in front of your witness bench and telling you that it's a problem. I think, and you know, I think it does help. You look at the surveys on most trusted institutions in America, and the military now, since about 1988, has been by far the most trusted institution in America. And the least trusted institution in America is Congress. So, yes, it can make a difference, but I think at the end of the day, a lot of these members have to represent their constituents. And unless you can find a way to help them make this work for their constituents, you're going to see a lot of problems no matter who's telling them it's a threat.
That's a question that I could probably go on a long time about, but I'll try and be short. Is that at the moment, our scientific understanding is moving incredibly rapidly, and the government policy making doesn't move that quickly. So it's a real challenge, but it's an important part of how we set these targets. It's one reason why most of the legislation includes a scientific review, so that there can be an evolution in the policy over, 50-year timescale. It is of utmost importance that the scientific community and the advocacy community continues to knock on Congress's door to talk about the reduction of emissions that looks like we need to achieve. It, you know, politics is always a give and take. It's one of the most important but also hardest lessons I learned as a scientist coming to work in D.C. is that at times politics trumps substance, and so it is critically important for those of us who care about the substance to make it politically relevant in order to move forward. And Sharon's point is right on about, any energy policy, which is essentially what climate is to a large degree, is really regionally based. And so, again, bringing home the impacts and the economic benefits to the regional level and just showing in some of these regions that they can actually do it, giving them the vision, is critically important.
Yeah, just very quickly, in the Old Testament, there's a conversation recorded between God and the prophet Ezekiel. And God says to Ezekiel, he says, you're the night watchman. If the enemy approaches at night and you give the alarm and the enemy still overcomes the city, you did your best. But if you fail to sound that alarm, then all of that blood is on your head. This group, the group in this room, we're in a very privileged position, aren't we? Because our science, our policy analysis, we've got a couple of choices. One is the easy choice, which is we can document very finely and very nicely this downward spiral of things. But if we really want to be known as the greatest generation, we actually have to roll up our sleeves and turn that around. So we've been given a great opportunity, but the national security community also really has a big responsibility.
Actually, also, Anna, at the very beginning, you posed a question about the national intelligence assessment, and I think the intelligence community also can play a very important role. And the NIA didn't get as much traction as it should have or could have, partly because it was wholly classified. But and so an unclassified product would help. But the fact that they did it, and the fact that the Director of National Intelligence shut down the debate about, I mean, there was debate on the Hill that was very unpleasant, that was, hey, we used to be looking for Osama bin Laden, and now we're looking for the March of the Penguins, about whether Intel should even be doing this. And he shut it down and said, yes, this is a threat to the United States, and it's appropriate for the intelligence community to be looking at that. That was significant, and it mattered. And I think that if we see the intelligence community doing more work on this, and particularly work that has some publicly available elements of it, that that'll make a big difference too, because it gets harder to justify your regional interests when there's more and more evidence coming from that community that there's a national interest at stake. So that's the other half.
I certainly hate to sort of cut off the conversation, but we did run over. This has been a really excellent conversation, hopefully one that we can continue. I hope you all join me in thanking our excellent panelists.
Why don't you go ahead and stay, if that's okay, if you have time. That would be tremendous. Great panel. I'm really learning a lot. Our final speaker is hard to describe because he's had at least three careers, right? He was an admiral in the Navy and was there for Desert Shield and Desert Storm. He's been in the private sector. And his last job was for 7 years as the head of NOAA, the most important agency in some ways when it comes to this kind of stuff, and one that I know and love. So with that, let me ask Vice Admiral Conrad Lattenbacher to come up and do...
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's indeed a great privilege and a pleasure to be here with you today. And I've always wondered whether it's better to be the last speaker before lunch or the first speaker after lunch. So today I get to test that hypothesis again. But anyway, thank you for your patience in staying with this, I think, very informative and interesting forum that we've had today. And I first of all, want to thank John Hamry and Jim Lewis for their work on this morning's activities and for making me part of it, And I want to thank Ron Sugar, Dr. Sugar, for coming and representing the private sector, which I feel strongly is an important part of the debate that we have today and clearly a huge part of the solution to some of the problems that we have, and our distinguished panel for devoting their time to this. And I could listen to them for a long time. It's very informative for all of us. What I want to do is sort of go back to the statements in the why we're here today. There were three premises that were set out as to what we're doing here today. And the first one was to talk about the serious and pervasive effects of climate change on national security. So we have the climate change and national security issue. I want to say a few words about that. And then we have building an infrastructure and capability to look at our Earth systems for adaptation and mitigation of the effects of climate change. So let's talk about that for a few minutes and close up with the need for U.S. leadership spearheading multilateral collaboration on these initiatives that would help us with the climate change issue. So let me talk about it in those three contexts. So first of all, let's talk about climate change and national security. And I don't hear a lot about that publicly, so I want to spend a few minutes making sure that we are on the record as to why it's important, why national security and climate change are so integrally connected. And I will state that the climate change is a vital and critical element of national security. That's clear to me, and I think that there are a number of studies and reports and work that's been done. And I admit it's hard to turn the Department of Defense around and move it from one piece to another. So that's a subject of another entire lecture I won't get into today. But there have been a number of studies, and they were mentioned. The one that I wanted to mention was the CNA study that was out over a year and a half ago and worked on before that. I know all the people on that panel, and they're very distinguished folks. I have a great deal of respect for them. If you look at that study, and there are numerous others that you ought to look at if you have not, they make conclusions that climate change poses serious threat to national security, and they go through it and explain some of the reasons why. And I'll just give you a few so that you have them as talking points. First, it acts as a threat multiplier. It's an exacerbating condition to many of the problems that you see in the world today. It adds on a pile of things that already create huge national security problems and make them worse. It adds to tensions in stable parts of the world because people start looking at new issues that come up because of climate change, and they create new instabilities and tensions in places that should be stable. And the other another important point they make is that climate change, national security, and energy dependence are related. And I think if we look at our defense policy, security policy, it's been to a great extent to protect shipping lanes and dependence on our various sources of energy that come from overseas. They talk about things like massive migrations. And I had the chance to look at my favorite television station, the Weather Channel. Well, I guess I should say AccuWeather now, but anyway, Weather Channel, the other day, and they were replaying the movies from the 1930s showing the Dust Bowl. And if you've never seen those, for those of you that are old enough, you've seen them. That was an extraordinary. There were some extraordinary pictures, and I hadn't looked at them for a while. But basically, what you saw in the Midwest during the 30s was the same thing I would see in the deserts of Saudi Arabia and Iraq, etc., were these huge dust storms that just obliterate the sky. This gets dark. It covers everything. You can't breathe. That was what happened in the United States, and it caused mass migrations. I mean, we lost a lot of people. We moved people. It was devastating from a social, humanitarian, economic perspective. And so if you don't believe, I mean, that's part of what we live in. That's the system we're embedded in. Climate is part of who we are and how we exist. So anyway, massive migrations, you can see that happening. Border tensions. You're going to have border tensions because of the need to deal with natural resources, the ability to maintain balance in economies and trade. So you're going to have those kinds of issues, border tensions, greater demands for rescue and evacuation efforts. We're talking about humanitarian issues before. You're going to have the conflicts over essential resources, not just the border, food and water. Okay, so you have those issues. Then that's what drives what the military has to do for national defense. And I want to get on to national security in a minute, too. But talk about military operations effects. The environment plays a huge part in that. Rising sea levels threaten our bases, and they also threaten maritime trade. 90% of everything we're wearing and live with today comes in on ships, and it's bought from all over the world. It comes into our ports. Our ports are dependent upon having an understanding of what the sea level is and all the infrastructure that goes with it. So are our military bases. When you have increased severe events, as Bill referred to, that hampers maintenance and operations. It's hard to operate, to do anything in the military when you have severe events. And I'll describe the situation in a minute. The interesting thing is, the next thing is fine, is a good Navy issue, and Skip Bowman brought that up. Changing ocean salinity requires changes in submarine and sonar operations, and it does. Drought conditions, when you talk about drought and as a severe event, you need new logistics and equipment for moving water, because now that becomes a huge part of the actual military operation. You are going to have new kinds of humanitarian operations. Remember that what our military does most of is humanitarian assistance. The Navy and the Marine Corps end up doing an awful lot of work helping coastal states that are suffering from hurricanes and floods and severe weather events. You have the whole Arctic issue of sea lane protection and the new sea lanes, as well as the changing environment up there. Just talk about the importance. First of all, it's never really understood very well. The military takes kind of environmental conditions for granted, and they're very happy if somebody else funds it, as long as they get the answer right up front. But I can tell you, after 40 years in the military, the first thing any operational commander does is get an environmental report before he goes anywhere. You have a weather report in the morning, just an easy thing. If you're in the Army, you care about bridges and trafficability and soil moisture and winds and all that. Everybody cares about that. And I have two interesting things. I had two in my office. First, let me make sure everybody realizes I'm not the administrator of NOAA anymore. All right, I'm a private citizen. Okay, so what you hear is not NOAA positions. They're mine. I've only been gone a month, so they haven't changed a lot. Okay, so you're not going to hear, probably not hear a lot of things that you haven't heard from me before. But I have big picture items in my office. One is a chart that I got from the Hadley Center in the UK, and it's a reprint of the hand-drawn meteorological chart that Eisenhower used to make the decision to invade on D-Day. Hand-drawn. The data collected by having picket ships out in various places, taking information, sending it back over very thin pipes that we used to have in those days, airplanes flying out, all collected very carefully and laboriously with a huge, in-situ, ground-based meteorological system, and that's what we used to make the decision. Of course, you remember there was a storm coming. They made it between the storms, and the storm then created a problem 3 or 4 days later, et cetera. But in any case, that was the chart. Now, on the other side of the wall, I have got a picture from a satellite today showing Katrina. One picture, one satellite, and it gives you the whole thing, and that's just a picture. What you're also getting sounding information, you're getting temperature profiles, you're getting humidity profiles, you're getting the basic raw data that you need to really determine what's going on and warn people. So we take that for granted now, but that's where we've come from. I'm going to waste too much time here, but there's another. As I sat, I was the Navy commander, deputy naval component commander in Riyadh during Desert Storm and Desert Shield, and as I was sitting one day with a briefing of military ops in the beginning of the war, I was sitting like here, and all the press were sitting out there, and there would be briefings usually twice a day, but one big one. In any case, the public affairs officer was up in front of the podium like I am, and he was just getting hammered by the press on why we didn't conduct the campaign the way we sort of said we would. You know, we spent months creating an air campaign. That's what I did there, that they have very definite steps, phases, do this, do that, go here, go there, whatever. And you'll remember that it didn't go according to the plan. So he was getting killed. And what the irony of it was that I sat there, I'm looking over their heads, and there's a monitor in the back that's showing the CNN weather coverage of Iraq. And the answers to all their questions were just to turn around and look at that chart, and they could see why certain targets were being struck and certain targets weren't. It's all clearly the meteorological conditions. And they all sat there, just couldn't figure it out. And the poor guy on the podium couldn't figure it out either. I thought for a second, maybe I ought to get up and try to save him. And I said, well, I don't know. I hadn't discussed that with General Schwarzkopf of doing that. Okay, so anyway. But it's there. Anyway, their recommendations, fully integrate climate change into national defense and security. The United States should commit to a stronger role in helping to stabilize climate change, the mitigation issue. We ought to help less developed nations build capacity and resiliency. We need within the military to improve our business processes to work on the energy efficiency question and deal with the energy sources, as was the question earlier. And we need to take a look at how this is going to impact our worldwide military network, our installation. So there's enough out there that points out that this is clearly a defense issue. Now, it's not just a defense issue. National security includes food security, agriculture, and fisheries. Let's talk about the effects there. And I can't go through each one of these, but this is a very distinguished audience. I'm sure you can understand that. Energy security. Obviously, we are energy dependent on many sources outside the country today. How are we going to deal with that? Water security, health security that we talked about earlier, the changes in diseases. Our industrial and economic security, how are we going to adapt and be able to deal with the changing climate in terms of having industry leaders and economic leadership around the world. Technological security. Are we going to be a leader in the technology that helps us deal with this? Every piece of our security issues, and you can go through them, space security, it's all there. In climate affects every one of them. We are basically a round-off error in the world population of 6.5 billion to going to 7, going to 9. We're 0.3. And so we are not in a position of strength. We need to take this very seriously. This is not something we can just, write off to we're the biggest and the best and whatever we do will be fine. That's not the case anymore. So there are opportunities for collaboration and versus competition, and I don't have time enough to talk about that, but we need to pursue those. Collaboration is important. It's too costly for one nation to do this alone, and you can't do it alone. And that is going to get me into Earth observations for a second. Globalization, everything is connected. Everything is connected. Now, you can see people are beginning to see it because our economies are connected. You can have watched all the fuss and fury that's happened because of our over-leveraging of mortgages and credit and these collateralized debt, instruments that we have today, these hugely complex, highly leveraged instruments that are spread so far and wide in our economic system that we can't recover from it very easily because so many people have invested in it, so many people have built these houses of cards on these things. In any case, everything is connected, especially, and the scientists here in this room know that the Earth is connected. The Earth is a system of systems. Oh, everything is connected. So why Earth observations? And Earth observations are important not just for climate. Obviously, climate affects everything, but they're important for all of the issues that we have. They're biological, chemical, physical. So Earth observations are absolutely needed for climate. So let me, since I'm here, at CSIS, and I want to thank CSIS, which I forgot in the beginning, for having this forum, and my good friend John Hamry, who I've been a great fan of his for many, many years, that has supported these issues and initiatives to be discussed. If you look at the study that they just did, it came out from a forum they had in London. It's called the Earth Observations of Global Change, July 2008. And I'll only make one quote from it, but I think it's summarizes it pretty well. The ability to observe, understand, and subsequently adapt to our world is a key requirement for civilization. Observe, understand, and adapt. That's the scientific method. We observe and we take a look and figure out what we had, and then we try to figure out how to understand it, and then we try to push that into the future, and then we try to adapt to it. So if this, you don't do that without having the basic data and the information. It's fundamental to our economy, and it's fundamental to society to having Earth information today, and we take it for granted, unfortunately. The issues about the famous question from a congressional hearing is, why do we need the National Weather Service when I can just turn on the Weather Channel? So the lack of understanding of where our basic information comes from is rife. And we in this room need to explain to others that it's not just comes out of the television set. There's something really big behind it that we need to invest in. Earth observations advance knowledge in Earth science areas. We are all stuck on this planet. I love Mars, and I like and going to the moon and all that, but we're not likely to get there en masse very soon. We're all here. We're going to be here for a while. So let's find out how we can live together, how we can manage our actions in relation to the global ecosystem and build them to be sustainable for the future. So Earth observations are good in the following. They advance our knowledge. They require cooperation. That's a good thing. We need more cooperation around the world. Global observations require cooperation. This is a way to cooperate. This is a way to build cooperation in hopefully a non-threatening, non-political way that gets people, don't tell them what their answer should be, but tell them what they need to base their answer on when they work on it. Give them the information in a way. So it's a win-win situation. That's very helpful. And I want to spend a couple minutes, a term I've used before, but given that this is a security, we're talking about national security, is the term environmental intelligence. Earth observations are environmental intelligence. They argue about whether the intelligence community ought to be doing that for the military, and I don't know about that necessarily. It should be certainly involved with climate change, but what we all do when we do Earth observations is provide the basis for environmental intelligence, and that's what we need. We need to think of it more that way. I like the point there is no demand from DOD for it. No demand signal. I want to talk about that in a minute. There are some demand signals out there, and I'll give you an important one that we worked on with colleagues in NOAA for the last few years, and that's the National Integrated Drought Information System, which is really a climate forecasting capability. We go beyond weather. We talk about climate. And I was pleased to see Governor Richardson to be nominated. He was a leader of the Western Governors Association, and he worked hard to help build the coalition of support for a National Integrated Drought Information System. Congress passed a law helping to establish it. We've gotten a little bit of money to get it started, and it's a regional thing. And I want to talk about regional things in just a minute. But those ideas of getting the intelligence so that we can provide regional information, and certainly in drought, very important to have an understanding of being able to predict it for water management, for agriculture, and for public safety and humanitarian needs in places where it's happening. And you also need to know that there are economic systems. It's connected to a larger piece of societal values and responses. It's not just an interesting science experiment. It is something that affects human beings and provides information for making decisions on our condition. Earth observations allow us to be proactive versus reactive. We'd like to know enough so we can project into the future. Interesting. Let me talk just a second about. I really like Ron Sugar's ideas. I do believe in taking data and producing knowledge out of it, and it needs to be done regionally. And we do have RESAs. RESAs are a good start. They're not perfect, and they don't have enough support yet for money and those sorts of things, which obviously many of these things that we're underinvested in, and I've said that for a number of years. But there's also an example here that we need to not be so cavalier about the amount of information we have. Yes, we have a lot of information, but there are many places where we don't have information. So we need to still invest in the observing systems, the right pieces of it, and we need to invest in the way to get that data collected and provide decision-making systems. So it's an end-to-end problem. And when we talk about Earth observations, I wrote down on my notes here, it's end-to-end. I'm not talking just about getting tables of radiances from satellites or temperature streams from buoys in the water. I'm talking about providing it in formats to developing nations' leaders as well as developed nations that, yeah, hey, this is what it says, and maybe I ought to do something about it in a fashion where people can make decisions. So there's another example here. Lieutenant Maury, that's a great example. I'm going to go back a little bit further to 1807, which is another example about observing. If you remember, NOAA encompasses a lot of different agencies. It was built in the 1970s and it's a great idea, and it ought to be codified in law, I believe, which hasn't been done yet, but it ought to be. It brought together all the ocean and atmospheric agencies together. And one of those agencies is the Coast and Geodetic Survey. So in 1807, we didn't have any data at all. And as we became a nation and we couldn't rely on the United Kingdom anymore or Great Britain to provide charts and harbor entrance safe passages into our harbors, Thomas Jefferson and Congress created the Coast Survey. And the Coast Survey was designed as a scientific organization. We hired people from Europe to come over and do it, and knew what they were doing, and surveyed the coast and provided the charts that allowed us to begin our maritime trade and become a great power. And so that's an example of getting data and investing in the data that's needed at the time. And we need to keep doing that. It's not over. We have not finished with that. So where have we been very effective in Earth observations? And I think I will use the example of GEO, the group on Earth observations, just completed the fifth plenary in Bucharest, Romania. It's something where the United States has been a leader. It has a commitment now of 77 countries. Another five joined this last month. And some 51 UN and United Nations organizations that have agreed we need to have a global Earth observing system of systems. That organization has grown rapidly. It has U.S. leadership. It's a ministerial level, which is where it has to be. It has to be high level. It has relevance to developing nations. It's a worldwide collective organization designed to help everyone. It is focused on practical benefits. It's not focused on building a scientific research machine. It's focused on benefits, responding to disasters, looking at weather, the climate observing system, energy, water, agriculture, ecosystems, biodiversity. Each one of these categories, they call them benefit areas, and they are the guts of this organization. So it's not about the observing system. It's about the information and the data that come from regional centers, hopefully. They'll be around the world to people who need, average citizens, leaders, who need the information to make reasonable policies. And it can do that with information that we share around the world. So there is a good example that is in place, and that it's important for us to support, because it takes into account all the questions that I heard about today. And we talk about health, we talk about capacity building, talk about humanitarian concerns, talk about investing in the social science piece of it. That is all part of this. Let's go to U.S. leadership here so we don't run too late for you. U.S. has demonstrated leadership, and I will give you the World Summit on Sustainable Development. We sent a very distinguished and broad-ranging group of people to Johannesburg in 2002. And U.S. leadership is welcome there. It's continued to be welcome. The G8, U.S. has led in the G8. The G8 has taken on climate change, and it's taken on Earth observing as a basis of on the basis of what came out of the World Summit on Sustainable Development. My experience is going around the world dealing with this is that U.S. leadership is welcome. People welcome us. They want to talk to the United States. They want the United States to be involved, and they really like bilateral operations. They really just want a special relationship. They want to hug you. They want a special relationship with the United States. Everybody wants a special relationship with the United States. The key is to take that bilateral love and turn it into multilateral efforts that are collaborative and broad-ranging to bring a large group of people together. I might add we need that within our science communities, too, in the, between meteorologists and astronomers and a few other, you know, groundwater folks, et cetera. We have been welcomed. We have taken a beginning. I think it's important to keep going there. And there are drivers, and I just want to make sure first of all, everything's getting more expensive. We all know that, and the economies are not doing well. So there's resource shortfalls. There's rising costs. So there's benefit to sharing our knowledge and sharing our ability to be. We don't need every country in the world does not need to have a radar satellite. We could do it with one constellation of radar satellites that are, you know, worldwide, collaborative. We could save money and we could provide the coverage that's needed if we would collaborate. That goes for ocean, for land, for earth, for atmosphere, for space. Economic priorities drive us to the fact that we need to be more collaborative together. Technological and scientific needs. Again, these are worldwide problems. It's going to take a worldwide effort to deal with it. The expanding benefits. You heard Bill talk to you about the payback. It's huge payback to having the kinds of technical knowledge that come from collaborative systems. Now, what can the United States do? And then I'll stop for a second and let you ask me some questions. We have to fund our share of the system. So we are leaders. If we want to be leaders, we have to take, you know, we have to get out in front and be at the head of the pack, and we have to fund our share of the world system. That goes for space. We need to fund our share of the space system. We need to look at in-situ observation systems, in-situ meaning on the ground or in the water, under the ocean. We need desperately to fund and invest and understand the need for continuity. We have, for climate change, you have to have continuous observations. You cannot let them die. I want to talk about a little aside on that in a minute. So satellite systems that certainly for NOAA, which is your environmental operator of satellites, the USGS also does Landsat, so there's two organizations that do it, but GOES-R and NPOES are critical. We need those satellite systems. They need to be funded. They need to develop. They need to be put up on time, and they need to be continued. We need to have a global climate observing system. It's part of the UNFCCC. It's been supported by the United States for a long time, and it has been at all of these meetings, including the one in Poland. This is supported as an absolute essential piece of having any kind of a worldwide solution to stopping rising greenhouse gases and doing whatever we can to mitigate against future climate change. We need to have, let's just take one example, a global carbon observing system. We are not going to be able to come up with a policy solution to carbon until we have a system that measures carbon. I mean, it's just kind of kindergarten, okay? And this is the biggest lessons that they learned from the European Union's emissions trading scheme include the fact that they couldn't really set accurate emissions. Without accurate emissions data, they couldn't set effective emissions caps. And how do you get emissions data? Well, right now we do it by taking chemical equations and multiplying out and see how much you burned. Okay, and so, okay, how much did they burn? How much, where did it come from? Whose numbers are they? I'd say we need some system that verifies it and does it so that everybody agrees that it's done fairly. And there's no way to game the system. The Kyoto Protocol is the Clean Development Mechanism. Again, one of the lessons learned, the need to ensure the credibility of emission reductions presents a significant regulatory challenge. So if you don't have credibility of emission reductions, how can you have – you've got a regulatory – nobody's going to agree. You have this continual political furball that we have. Okay, so what are things that we could do to help? First of all, we need to rationalize what we do in the United States. Right now we have – and we've made a lot of progress from the Global Climate Change Research Program to the CCSP. We need to go further. We need to rationalize our system so that the demand signal shows up. And I have been a proponent for the last – well, I've been a proponent for a long time, but I've been saying it more vocally in the last year and a half – is a national climate service. You have to have a national climate service. And I don't want you to think of a national climate service as the Department of Climate, which would then include everything. Agriculture, energy, and we'll have the great national assessment. It will do everything. We can't produce a national assessment on a regular basis. We need to manage it the way we manage our government. The Weather Service, it's an operational agency. You go to the Weather Service, may not like their forecasts or their information, but you know what it is. You can call them up to Congress. You can ask them what they're doing. You get their error bars. You can look at the data. It's a public good. It's out there for everybody to see. One operational source of weather data from the government that everybody uses. The Energy Department uses it for their projections of how much fuel we should stockpile. The electric companies use it, and that's fine. And if they want to use AccuWeather or the Weather Channel to help with that, that's fine. They certainly can use private sector information. But there is a basis from which we can do our assessments, that we can be challenged in court and have some legal defense, which we don't have today. So what we have today are research results. We have research results from NOAA. We have research results from NASA. We have research results from Energy Department. We have research results from the universities. And they all want a piece of the action, and they should have it. We should give – research is important. We need research. But we also need to have a system that takes the best of the research, puts it in one place, gets one guy to stand up and say, here's what it is, as I would do for the Weather Service. Here's what our Weather Service is doing. Here's what we need to invest in and be questioned and whatever and deal with it, have it out in the open, and then start from there and put these benchmarks in place. So until we do that, and I'm really – both the House and Senate have worked language like that into some potential legislation and set this up in a way that we have, first of all, taking away from no one. I don't want to cut out NASA's role in space or the Energy Department's role in building big computers and running lots of models. We need all of that. It's good for research, but we need an operational agency. So this – in that, let me stop with this point. We need to invest in research continuity. We're not doing that. The decadal study from the National Research Council – last year, or a year and a half ago, indicated what we needed to do that. And I'm here for research continuity. But people mix up research continuity with the idea of having operational continuity. And so I want to tell you, you need to invest in the research, and we need to have – you can't let research satellites die either. You've got to keep research going, and you've got to be on cutting edge. But you've got to take the best of research, and you've got to turn it into operations in one agency that provides – climate information. So commitment to a climate observing system in the United States is fundamental to being able to come to agreement on how and I don't want to presume – I'm not here to talk policy solutions, whether it's a carbon tax, whether it's cap and trade, whether it's some other mechanism. You cannot set them up without having some fundamental agreement as to what the baseline is that we're going to work from. And if we don't do that, we're going to continue to have it be a partisan battle, and I really decry that type of business with this. Certainly, NOAA is not a partisan organization. Anyway, so I want to thank you for the opportunity to preach to you one more time. I see a lot of friends out there have heard this before, but it's still it's still an important message. So I thank you very much for your opportunity. I wish you well. Sure. I don't have to go back to the Commerce Department today, okay?
We have time for a couple questions, so if there are some questions. Let me point out, too, that a number of times folks mentioned an earlier CSIS report on Earth observations, and we put some copies out in the back. So any questions? We got one over there. Go ahead. We have two. Yeah, that's right.
Hi, I'm Maria. I do water. Oh, sorry. My name is Talia. I'm doing water and conflict. I'm researching with the FAO, and I'd like to see, well, with the community. This is a great panel, and I'd like to see also some international input in there. I'm sure that we also are leaving the UN to do that sort of thing. But it'll be nice from the U.S. standpoint that, for example, in my case, I just became a U.S. citizen. Either could be that for a good cause or for a bad cause for you guys. But we have some, well, one of the things, you know, we talk about national security, and we have a lot of immigration coming in. If we can maybe somehow do some panel or something that we could bring countries and see what they are doing at their side, somehow we might be able to help immigration in the sense that we can leave the folks out there and help us, you know, help to be productive in their country. But maybe from more information we can get and be humble ourselves a little bit. And I know that the U.S. has a lot to offer, and that's great. I mean, I'm thankful for that. At the same time, I'm sure if we could learn from other countries and see what they are doing and being able to somehow see how can the national security be built up from that side.
Thank you. I certainly agree. I noticed in the paper that we're number 17 in terms of helping other countries, and the Dutch are number one. So we certainly could move up in it. I don't have a problem with that kind of an approach. Thank you.
Great. We had one more. Go ahead, please. I don't know if it's good or bad to speak right before lunch, but in any case.
Hello, and thank you very, very much for your comments. And my name is Renee LaDuke-Clark, and I'm from NOAA. I just wanted to mention a few quick things I've heard from a few of you, namely about the concept of continuity and basically the danger of deferring investment. I believe that was something that Bill Hook said, and basically I was interested in having you comment, sir, as well as possibly some members of the panel, about what can the broader community inside of this room and possibly outside of this room do to better raise awareness about these threats of continuity. I would say that broadening that beyond this room, especially in relation to the folks inside of the appropriations world. I can give one certain example of that. Basically, inside of the FY08 omnibus, at the very last minute, NOAA just happened to have a $44 million cut, which had to go to its GOES-R budget, which then yielded a multiple month delay in getting that system launched. How do you think that we can best communicate with this broader community to ensure that these threats do not happen in the future?
Well, I've been working hard to get funding for that for a long time. The public doesn't understand how much the benefit is there from the systems, and they're hanging by a thread. I mean, that's part of the problem. There's a single system. It's only a single geostationary system. There's one. So if you don't like GOES-R, then there's nothing else. I mean, there's no intelligence system. There's no something that NSA is doing. There's no something from the Energy Department. This is it. There's one system. So if you don't fund it and you don't keep it going continuously, you're going to lose continuity. Now, do you want to be the President of the United States who has to say, gee, I couldn't tell you that Katrina was coming today because we forgot to launch our satellite last year? Now, that's going to happen. That is going to happen unless we do something about it. And as far as I can tell, this president wants to do it. Congress wants to do it. But yet in the end, when we get an omnibus and everybody gets squirreling around, it goes somewhere. And we have to make a bigger noise about that. If we're not going to fund redundant systems, which haven't been in the military, I like redundant systems. We don't have redundant systems. We have single failure systems for environmental today, and we haven't even started on the climate world yet, and we're already in danger of losing continuity that we've had from research, let alone from operations. So I can't say it any more plainly than that, but I'm going to keep saying it, and I hope everybody in this room does. let them. This is great. They want to hear from
the
panel.
Let me. This has been a really informative session, certainly for me. And you've been very patient. We didn't schedule any breaks because we wanted to get through a lot of material. And so, with that, let me ask you to join me in thanking the Admiral and the panel for this.